10th, 1997. My name is Roger Hertz, and I'm sitting with Ray Hayworth in Thomasville, North Carolina. And this is an interview for SABRE, the Society of American Baseball Research. Ray, thanks for sitting down with us.
Well, good. I'm glad to have you here, and glad to talk with you and visit with you. Usually, one thing brings up another in this baseball interviews, and I usually think of something that happened 50 or 60 years ago that I haven't thought of in quite a long time.
Well, you grew up around here, did you?
Yes, I did, over here just south of High Point, a place called Springfield Archdale, and grew up there and went to grade school, and then on into high school. I went to Trinity High School and then to High Point High School, and from there I went to prep school over at Oak Ridge here near Greensboro, and it was known for their great baseball teams they had there, and I was so fortunate to be invited over by Coach Earl Holt, whom I regard as one of the finest coaches I ever met in my life. And he did so much for me, and I had a real break when I got to Oak Ridge, and I have to tell you that I was a pretty fair high school pitcher. I was 7-2 that year at High Point High School. I went over there and I thought, well, this will be a breeze to make this pitching staff of Colonel Holt. We worked out about a week or 10 days, and he called me in the office and he said, Ray, I am overloaded with pitchers. I don't have a catcher. But he said, I want to tell you something. I have been thinking about you, and I know that you caught some in high school. But he said, observing you out here on the field, he said, I believe you have one of the finest arms I ever looked at. But he says, you can throw the straightest fastball I ever saw. And he said, what a catching arm you could have. So I told him I'd be very happy to try for catching, and he coached me there, and I got along real good, and he taught me how to get the ball away very quickly, and I went there in 1923 during the 3 years I was there, and the fourth year I was in Detroit in a major league uniform and playing games. Right out of prep school, never played.
No minor league?
Nothing except semi-pro in the summertime. And I went directly after my fourth year from the day I went to Oak Ridge. I joined the Detroit club in Chicago, and the first major league game I ever saw, I was in a major league uniform, and a little Stoner pitched that day against the White Sox and beat them 1-0. And I just thought, boy, how great.
You're in heaven, huh?
Yeah, and I got to meet Ty Cobb and talk with him, and he was a very interesting person. I was glad I had the opportunity to meet with him, because he not only called me in the morning I met him in the hotel lobby there. He said, well, kid, I don't guess you expected to make the major league this year, did you? And I said, no, sir, I sure didn't. He said, well, Johnny Bassett broke his leg and we wanted to bring you over here. So from that point on, I got to be very friendly with Ty Cobb. And he was always very good to me, and we remained friends for many, many years after his career ended. I'd see him in Chicago and around. And,
he was managing Detroit then.
He was a manager in 1927, and he played one more year for Connie Mack in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. But I am the sole surviving player that played with him in Detroit in 1926. He was a playing manager.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he got a kick out of me for some reason or other. He put me in a game in Philadelphia, and I got a base hit off old Spitballer Quinn, and went down to Washington and went out to the ballpark, and he said, "Son, you're catching today." And I just about scared me to death, so I got all my gear and stuff. And when I looked over to the other pitcher warming up for Washington, it was Walter Johnson. No, I really got scared.
Were you more scared about
hitting against them? I was awed by these people that I'd heard about all my life. And here I am up there with them. And I hit against Johnson that day twice. And here's the oddity of this one ball game. The score was tied in the seventh inning, and Ty Cobb pinch hit for me and got a double and beat Johnson the game.
So, remember who was pitching that day for Detroit?
We had a couple of pitchers in there. I expect we had about three in there before it was over. But, at that time we had some great pitchers there, Earl Whitehill and George Yulee and pitchers like that. And another thing that comes to mind, while I was in Detroit, 11 years altogether, seven players off of those teams made the Hall of Fame. I thought that was most unusual to have seven players. And Ty Cobb headed the list. He was the first one inducted. And I thought that was a real fortunate thing for me to get to play with players of that caliber.
And he played with Gehringer?
Yes, Gehringer was there all the time. I spent all my years there with Charlie Gehringer. And of course, 34 and 5, it's easy to remember all the players we had at that time. Great pitching. Cochran and I were the two catchers. He caught against all the right-hand pitchers, and I got to hit against the left-handers, so both of us benefited by that. It meant that he caught two-thirds of the games. I caught about a third.
What was it like playing with Cochran?
Real good. Yeah. First thing he told me down in spring training, he said, "Ray, I've been playing against you here in the league, but said, now I'm the manager." He said, "One thing I want you to do, you go out, run your own ball game. I don't want to have the burden of calling any pitches for you or tell you what to do. You run the game." And he did.
I was going to ask you about that, because these days so many pitchers are called from the dugout. Yeah. But you called all your own game.
No, he said, you run your own game. And I did. And of course, I knew all the pitching, been with the pitchers, kind of grew up with Auchern, Schoolboy Rowe, and Tommy Bridges, and all those fellows. And it made a real good setup for me. And I was most fortunate to be on a great ball club. And we had a great club in Detroit in 34 and 5. In fact, we finished 34 and 5. We won American League pennant, and we were in the first division five consecutive years before I was sold to Brooklyn in the fall of 38.
You won 100 games, 101 actually, in 34, right?
Yeah. My greatest year of catching was 1932. I caught 100. I was in 131 of the 154 games that year. I didn't hit as much. Naturally, I was overworked. But it was a great experience, and just great to be in the league at that period in time. There was so many great players. My goodness, Tris. I think about Tris Speaker and Eddie Collins and the great pitching that I saw, and coming on down through the years, and the question asked me most often by people at card shows and things, they said, "Who's the toughest pitcher you ever faced?" And it doesn't take me long to answer. I just said, "Bob Feller." And I said, he just was the most deceptive pitcher I ever faced. And the only trouble about him, I was right-hand hitter and he was right-hand pitcher, and his whole delivery was back here, and I'm standing up there. I'm worried he doesn't exactly know where I am. So his deception and all. When he'd turn and throw to the plate, hard to follow the ball, and he had great stuff, really great. I got a note back there on my board. He was over here at Greensboro one night at an all-star game. And he sent me a message by some ladies that lived over on our subdivision, and he called me old folks. Still does when I see him. Well, he can. He was a boy 18 years old up there when I was a veteran.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nice to see some of those old guys now and then.
How about all the pitchers that you handled? Did the game in the 12 or 14 years that you played, did the game change a lot from a pitching standpoint?
No, not much. The same way the spitballers actually kept going out as they finished their careers while they were through. And generally, as I look at games now and back then, Greg Maddux with Atlanta is the nearest thing to one of the greatest pitchers I ever saw. He can do so much with a ball with such great control that I think he's the best pitcher in baseball right now. And could say that for all time because Jen Crowder was that type pitcher. Jen could put on a little and take off a little and move the ball in and out and up and down and beat you, and you could catch him with a finger glove.
Were there as many new pitchers then as there seem to be today? You know, every year there's the pitch of the year. So.
There's always a crop, you know, it comes on every year, and it's always been that way and always will be.
Not so much the people, but the pitches themselves.
Yeah.
The screwballs and...
Yeah. Yeah, they come up with their different pitching. They have great pitching coaches now that teach them all these different ways of moving the ball in and out, up mm-hmm. and down, and making the ball move, changing speeds. Best pitch in baseball today is a good change of pace.
When you watch a game today, what do you look for in a pitcher?
Well, I try to remember scouting days and scouting pitchers, and I watch the pitcher and how he works and the different pitches they use. And it's very much the same. I might have said this earlier here, I watch a lot of games just like that right there, over there now that you see on my screen. I get all the information I want off of the screen, and some of these guys can out-talk a certain saw. But I don't have anything against them.
Mm-hmm.
They're very knowledgeable. But I just like to watch the game as if I were sitting in the stands watching it. And I enjoy it more that way. So that's why I say I enjoy it right here, right in front of my set.
As a catcher, you had to also deal with base stealers. Has that changed pretty much from when you were playing?
About the same, I would say. I don't say much difference. The good base runners have always been around and always will be, and we got some great ones right now. And we had some great ones back then. Ben Chapman was a great base stealer. I threw him out three times in one ball game in the Yankee Stadium one day. I got a picture of it back there on my board. I laugh about it now because he and I never did get along very well together. He was always after me, and he never could get at the plate.
So what caused that?
I could get out of his way.
No, I mean, what caused him to always be
just
after?
Just after each other. Competing.
You played for some pretty decent managers, too.
Yes, I did. I've always contended that you never really played in the major leagues until you played at least 1 year for Casey Stengel, which I did. And
What year was that?
I played for him in Toledo in 1929, and they sent me down there. He was a good hitting instructor,
mm-hmm.
and I was strictly a pull hitter, and he taught me how to hit the ball to right field, hit behind the runner, hit and run more, stay away from double plays. As a result, that year I hit 330 down there, went back to Detroit and stayed my whole career up there.
Was there any indication then that he would be as good a manager as he turned out to be?
No, but it was just something about Casey. I wish I had a tape of some of the meetings he held in the clubhouse. I had to get back in my locker to keep from laughing at the guy. He was so funny. And I used to go to the writers' dinners, and Casey'd get up and make his speech, and when he'd get through with it, I'd say, "Boy, wasn't he great?" And somebody would say, "Yes, but what did he say?" He was a wonder, I tell you.
You also played for Bucky Harris?
Yes, I played for Bucky, you know, from 29 to 34. Bucky was a good manager. Yeah, I remember playing against him when he was still playing manager over in Washington. But he don't overlook the fact that what a great long career Bucky had as a major league manager. Over 20 years with the Hall of Fame. He was a very good manager.
Would you say Casey, one of those, had the greatest influence on your career? Any special person in mind?
Well, he had a lot to do with it. My success and what he taught me in hitting helped me so much. But I don't know. I liked all the managers. I liked Billy Southworth. I played for him. And a lot of them I could think of that I played for, but just some of them kind of stand out in my mind. But they were outstanding managers. So, yeah, you covered a lot of ground when you talk about how many years that I was in a major league uniform and how many managers and players. And I can take that baseball encyclopedia there and sit here all day long and turn sheet after sheet and remember most of the names I see on there. Of the older players.
When you walked into Yankee Stadium or Briggs or any of those fields and you there was a game that day and you knew you were going to play with and against some of these great ball players, what did it feel like?
Well, when we went in there in 34 and 5, there was Ruth and Gehrig and Lazzari and all the great Dickey and all the great players were there. We played in there one day, with a game at stake, and 77,000 people. I had a home run off of Gomez in that game, knocked in a couple runs. I told him this at a baseball meeting up in New York. I said, when I rounded first base, I said, I felt like a bird flying, but by the time I got to second, it suddenly dawned on me how many times Babe Ruth had made that same trip around there. And I said, here I was making my first one. He'd probably go around there about 400 times during his career. But I said, it was a great feeling to get a base hit at the crucial time in one of the most crucial games we had all season. And they're the things that stand out in your mind and as a player and as you think back over the years of great things that happened. And there's so many of them. It's like Charlie Garrett just said one time, he said, what's your most thrilling experience? And he said, I can't say that anyone. He said, they just keep coming. And you think, well, that's a great experience. You might have one just as great the next day. So that's the way baseball is.
I understand what you're saying. I think for a fan, it's almost the same way. But if you had to pick one memory, one game, one instance that sticks out in your mind more than any other, is that possible?
I think that game in New York, it meant so much and hit the home run when I did. We won a doubleheader that day, and that turned the pennant race around, and just practically, we went on to win from right there on. So that had to be one of the greatest games I ever played in.
Did the catcher no-hitter?
Caught close, but I caught Tommy Bridges in that famous game in Detroit where he pitched against Washington and went down to the ninth inning with two men out. Perfect game. And Walter Johnson was managing the Washington club, and he had Joe Judge and Sam Rice over on the bench, both left-hand hitters. But he called Dave Harris in to hit a right-hand hitter to hit against Bridges. First pitch he threw right up here, and he broke his bat and hit it right over shortstop. That's the only hit they got all day. And he got some mad toast, gets in a perfect game. Within one out. So.
Did they get the next guy?
Yeah. He comes so close to pitching a perfect game, but yet we blame the manager for sending a right-hand hitter up there when he had two left-hand hitters hit against our right-hand pitcher. So we put all the blame over on him. Yeah.
Are there any odd plays that you took part in or that happened while you were on the field that you remember?
I played in a game one day in St. Louis where there was 32 runs scored, and I was walked intentionally twice in one inning.
Who was hitting behind you?
I don't know who was hitting behind me, Rogel or somebody, but the pitcher was hitting behind me that day because they walked me twice to get to the pitcher, and it all happened in the same inning, believe it or not. That's one of the oddities I ever was faced with.
Speaking of the pitcher hitting as you did, what do you think about the designated hitter?
I don't think it adds anything to the game. I think it hinders the game. It takes something away from it. I'd rather see them play like they do in the National League. Don't have any designated hitter. Play the game like it ought to be. Of course, that's just one opinion.
Who are the best defensive players? Everybody talks about hitting, but do any defensive players stick out in your mind?
Yeah, DeRocher was one of the better shortstops I ever saw. Not much bad, but man, what a pair of hands. Fast hands. Great hands. Gerzer was a great fielder, great second baseman. Though there's so many. Rogel was a great shortstop. And I think should have been considered for the Hall of Fame. He had so many great years. But, there's so many. It's just so many. You start trying to name who's the most valuable here and there, and you can name three or four more that are just as good. So it's not really fair to say that who was the best. There have been so many good ones.
What was the press like in those days?
All right, real good. Good press in Detroit. Yeah, we had a bunch of good writers there. Sam Green and Sal Singer and all those fellows. They were real good and always very fair. I got some wonderful write-ups back there and some on the wall that they did that I'm very proud of.
A little different than today?
I really don't know him today. The one I know best today is Harry Carey, because in 1945 he broke in as manager and I was still playing, and I remember that over in St. Louis that day. And he mentioned a few times since then that I was playing when he broke in as an announcer, and he's been there forever.
You know, that 34 series that you played in, that was that seventh game is a rather memorable game.
Yes, it was. We had a good series down to the seventh game, and when Frankie Frisch doubled off Walker, and that wrecked us in that game. They beat us badly, but it was a good series up to that point. And every game was decided by one run, except two, I guess. We beat Charlie Root pretty bad. But the two Deans at that point in time in their careers were at their peak. They just were great. They had those that reminded me a lot of Walter Johnson's sidearm slingers, and the fastball would climb. you get right up here and you figure it's a strike, but by the time you get up here ready to hit it, it's up out of the strike zone. And both of them pitched that way. And they were great for a short period of time. I got to know Paul real well. I was on the New York club when he went over there. Yeah, there were a couple of real phenoms.
What was that seventh game like when in the sixth inning when Medwick had to leave the field?
I don't know how they got so many cabbage heads and apples and oranges and stuff to throw. I think they had people running to the clubhouse, the concession stand, bringing more out there for them to throw. So they covered left field. But when Judd Landis called Medwick over told him he was through for the day and put the thing back under control, and they cleaned up the field and went ahead and finished. I got a film of that play at third base, and it was uncalled for. He didn't have to run into one like he did because the play was not that close or important. He just did it. So there's a great ball player, Medwick. Boy, he could hit. Really hit. St. Louis Club at that time was a great club.
Anyone special you remember other than
Yes, I remember Glenn and old Charlie Root and a whole bunch of those guys. I remember seeing them around with them a lot years after in scouting. They were scouting also. Yeah, Billy Herman, Stan Hack. Stan was a great third baseman. I played for him. I coached for him in Chicago in 1955 when he was manager. Yeah, that's the last time I wore a major league uniform.
1955?
Yeah, coach. Yeah.
Any umpires that you remember from those days?
Well, the umpires always very fair, honest. They made some mistakes, like all of us make mistakes. We had one umpire named Cole that used to kick on some balls and strikes he'd call. He'd say, "Ray, that was a tie pitch. I could have called it either way." Be sure that you call it up on my way. I can remember some great umpires in the league. Yeah.
But as a catcher, you must have been either not necessarily close with umpires, but had a lot of interaction with them.
I got along good with the umpires because I never was one to give them a rough time. I just, if I thought a ball was a strike, and it was important, I'd let them know that what I thought it was, and. They were understood, and they got a lot of flack from the catchers, but I was not a umpire baiter. I just didn't like all that grumbling and complaining. I just get on with the game, and that's the way it should be.
What were the owners like that you played for?
Well, I got a good story. I'm glad you asked that question. When I was called over to Detroit, I broke in with Toronto in the spring of 26. Basser broke his leg. And they called me up. I was rooming with Carl Hubble, by the way.
In Toronto?
In Toronto. Yeah. We both were the Toronto club. So I went over to Syracuse for a series. Next morning, Dan Alley, our manager, called for me to come up to his room. And I told Hubble, I said, "This is my last day with you, buddy. They're going to send me to Decatur, sure, in the world, where everybody went, or Evansville with Bob Coleman. It was a farm club." Mm-hmm. So I went up to the room, and Dan Alley says, "Ray, our business manager, O'Hara, will get all your transportation, everything set up. Said, you're going to join the Detroit club in Chicago tomorrow." And I thought, I don't believe I could ever get over there by myself. I'd never been to New York before. I went up there. But old had a pitcher named Jess Dahl. He said, "Now, you just take your tickets, you get on the train, you get in your berth, and the next morning you tell them you want to get off at the North Side Station, go to the Forest Hotel. So I did. Went over there and I got off, and then when I walked in the lobby, old Sam Gibson was one of our pitchers, and I was talking with him, and he said, "There's Cobb getting off the elevator. Let's go over and speak to him." I repeat what I said earlier. He said, "Well, son, I'm glad to see you." He said, "I don't guess you expected to make the major leagues this year, did you?" And I said, "No, sir." And we got back to Detroit. Mr. Navin, the owner, sent for me to come up to the office. He wanted to see me, so I went up there. He says, "Son, what kind of a salary were you making over in Toronto?" I said, "Mr. Navin, they were paying me $350 a month, and that's more than I'd ever gotten in my life." He says, "Well, I want to tell you this, we don't pay anybody less than $500 a month here." He says, "Your salary will be $500. So that was a lot of money back in those days, and for me especially. That fall, when the season ended, I had a few greenbacks in my pocket, and you don't know what I did with them.
Sure.
I went down and bought myself a watch and chain, a trunk, a traveling suitcase, and everything I wanted, and an overcoat. I bought all the things that I wanted to have. When I got down home and got off the train, I don't think anybody knew who I was. I was dressed up.
Did you come back here?
No. I came to Christiansburg, Virginia. And I got off the train there and spent the night with my brother-in-law, which later turned out to be my brother-in-law, met me at the train, and we had a nice visit. And took me a couple of days to tell him and his dad how great it was to be in the major leagues. And my brother-in-law, who is here now, Dave will be here in a few minutes. He's the younger one of the family. He was 10 years old then. And that was a great feeling for me to be able to go down and buy what I wanted. And to top off a good story, I went down to High Point on Saturday after I got home. I was with a friend of mine, and I said, "Let's go around to the Ford place." Went around there and walked in, and this Mr. Hart, one of the salesmen, came over and said, "What can I do for you fellas?" I said, "You got any Ford cars around here?" And he said, "Yeah, we got some." I said, "Well, let me look at some." Had a coupe there that I like very much. I says, "How much is that car right there? I like the looks of that one." He said, $650. I said, "I'll take it. Put me a lock steering wheel on it. Some bumpers." I bought that car, and boy, I was just so delighted to have an automobile. And it was a good one. And you know how high they built them back then. We nicknamed it Old High Head. But it was just great to, things like that to stand out in my mind that about my earlier days in the game, and what a thrill it was to experience these things that I'd never known before.
And then 1927 came around, and what was it like negotiating for a salary? And
well,
how did that work?
They were very fair. They paid me about the average salary. I was an average player. And I got on up and better money. But I never made any real big money like Greenberg and Gerringer and Cochran, because I wasn't that caliber player. But I got a good salary. But I really got into what I thought was good money when I got into the executive side of baseball, when I become a scouting director and then director of player personnel.
For which teams was it?
Milwaukee. And I worked closely with general manager John McHale, and He gave me half of the roster to sign in the spring, negotiate with the younger players.
Which years was this?
This year was in 1930. Let's see, I have to think my years now up there. I went up there in 48, 9, 50. This was in 1961. And I was went on to Atlanta with them in 64. We went down a year ahead of the club, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I left there and went to Montreal my last 4 years with John McHale, who was a special assignment scout up there until I retired in 1973. Yeah.
Did you have a territory, or you went?
No, I never had a territory. I always did special assignment scout. We scout the top players that the scouts picked out around the country, and we'd go watch them play, make up our list for the draft, and they would select the players that they could get to, if they could get to them, would draft them in the draft. So,
any special players that you remember scouting?
I think the most important one that I scouted personally and helped make the deal on was Ernie Banks in Chicago. And he made the Hall of Fame. I got a picture back there on my board, and he said thanks to me on the picture that he sent my grandson.
How old was he when you were scouting
him? He had just come out of the service, about 19 or 20, and he was a good-looking shortstop. And we at that point in time, he was with Kansas City, had to buy his contract, so we did. And he made it a Hall of Famer. I helped Mr. Ricky scout all the colored clubs in New York. When the Brooklyn Club would be on the road, we'd go to, every Sunday we'd go to either the Yankee Stadium or Polo Grounds. The colored leagues would play a doubleheader, and they'd play four teams. So we get to see four teams every Sunday afternoon. We got tabs on all the colored players. And I'll tell you this little story. Mr. Ricky sent George Sisson and I up Springfield, Mass. One night to see a boy pitch. His name was Newcomb. And I watched him pitch. We did, and went back the next morning, went up to the office and had a meeting. Mr. Ricky said, "Ray, tell me about Newcomb. What did he look like?" I said, "Mr. Ricky, he can throw harder than anybody you got on your Brooklyn staff here right now." Boy, he jumped straight up. Signed him about a week later. They did. Clyde Supert did the signing. Of course, he made the Hall of Fame, and he was a great pitcher. And he and we scouted all those colored players, got a book on every one of them. That's why Mr. Ricky knew all about every one of them. And when he decided to break the color line, he walked right in and got the cream of the crop. We had the assignment of scouting all those players.
Campanella?
That's when I got my start in scouting, was scouting those colored players. And so it really was a breaking point in it.
This is the 50th anniversary of Robinson,
yes,
starting out with Brooklyn.
Watching that, yes.
What was that like? Do you?
Well, He took a lot of abuse, and the thing that hurt me, like when I was in Milwaukee, we go down to Houston and get off of the train down there, and instead of going, all of us going to the hotel, all the colored players, we had several in, would go over to a hotel where they could stay. Couldn't go down to the Rice Hotel and stay. But yet we'd get on the train, go from there right to Los Angeles, all stayed together, ate together, everything in the same, just like, you know, segregation. So it was really segregated at first. I was glad to see that go. But I've always felt that pretty good about having a hand in really helping break the color barrier in baseball.
Did you scout Robinson?
Yeah, I saw all those players. And he took a lot of abuse, but he was great.
Are there any players that you remember that made it easier for the black players to begin their careers?
It wasn't easy at first for a while. They really had to make their way, but look at the percentages playing now. One thing you got to admit about baseball, no matter what your color is or where you're from, the manager is, if you're the best shortstop he's got in on his staff, you're going to play shortstop. It doesn't make any difference to them. You're going to play the man that can play the position the best. That's why so many of them are coming on. They're better than the rest, and they're taking over. We're getting up there now, what, 70%? And they're good. They've got great talent. And we got some good white ones, too. I'm not overlooking that. We've got some great white players, and always will have. But where you take care of where they say there's about 20 million and play baseball every summer in this country and around, look how few ever get up there to play in the major leagues. Not many. Percentage is so much against them. The five things you have to look for in scouting a ball player. I just inject this as I think of it. Arm, feel, run, hit, power, and desire. Desire is number one. If he doesn't have the desire to compete and want to play, don't care how good he is in the other four, back away from him and go find somebody that does have desire. Because if you don't like to play this game, you're not going to do very well in it.
That's a good point, because of the players that you scouted and of the players that you played with, are there some that stick out just because of the desire they had?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe their skills weren't that
good. Yeah. Eddie Stanky was one of those kind of players. Boy, he had desire. He'd battle you every day and every inch of the way. He had a lot of Ty Cobb in him. Ty Cobb, talking about those five things, I'd rate Ty Cobb outstanding in all five departments. That's why how much I thought of him.
Other than Stanky, any players come to mind?
Mickey Mantle, if he hadn't hurt his knee and all, you could give him a one on all five things. But he was a great player. Of course, his knees went bad and all, but he could do it all in a switch hitter and hit the ball out of the park from either side of the plate. Just great.
How did your family feel when you first said, I'm going to be a baseball player?
Well, my dad used to say, you see, there were five boys in my family, and four of us played professionally, and all four of us catchers. Two of us played major league, and the others played minor league. And my dad used to say every day I grew up on a cotton and tobacco farm over here, a small one, and every day during our rest period, we'd get out there and play baseball. And he said, I wish you boys would quit fooling around with that ball. The first year I went away to play, the first paycheck I got, I sent him a check. He sat down and wrote me a letter, and it was a very touchy letter. And he was so pleased that I was playing baseball and getting paid for it. And he got to where he liked baseball, and they'd come up to Washington now and then when we go in there and spend a series with us. And they grew, my mother and dad both grew to be very, very interested in baseball, because they had to be. There were four of us playing.
Did you ever play with your brother? In the majors?
No, not with him. Played against him, and he came on after me.
Right.
See, he caught all for the 44 World Series for St. Louis Brown, and that was his rookie year in baseball. He was in six World Series games. And he lives up here at High Point now, and He's 81, still very active, plays golf, and good physical condition, drives his car everywhere. And he spent most of his career in scouting. He spent as many years in baseball as I did, but it was in scouting instead of playing. He had a bad knee and got that fixed, and so he's been very fortunate.
If you owned a baseball team today, what would you like to see changed about the game? What are the things about the game today that you like the most?
Well, I like.
Or would you sell it and take your money and go home?
I'd let somebody else do the work, and I'd sit back and watch them. Like Ted Turner does. He's got the best job in baseball. He's got the ballpark named after him. He owns the team. He just let somebody else do all the wearing and running of it. And I think he's got the best job in baseball. I don't recall any other incidents that
What was it like traveling in those days? Traveling with the team, traveling on the trains?
They always had two private Pullman cars. And one of them was for the regulars, and the others were the